The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. This morning, I thought of talking about many kinds of happiness. In one of the verses of the Dhammapada, I don't have the translation right exactly in my head, but it's something along the lines of, a wise person will forgo a lesser happiness for the sake of a greater happiness. And so I thought I'd talk about these various levels of happiness, these different kinds of happiness, and how we can start to recognize them, you know, cultivating happiness essentially through recognizing it. As I think I talked about last week, one of the good ways to cultivate some of these beautiful states of mind is through being mindful of them, actually recognizing when they're present. And so ways to cultivate happiness is to begin to recognize these qualities of happiness and to begin to understand which kinds of happiness are more congruent with the path of practice and which ones might actually be supporting craving and clinging. So the first level or most obvious kind of happiness that we're all familiar with is the happiness of sense pleasure. And this is, it's not a problem to have sense pleasure. I mean, I think sense pleasure gets a bad rap in Buddhist teachings. But it gets a bad rap because it is so easy with sense pleasure to want to have more and more of it. And so there's the happiness that comes from the sense pleasure. And because of that happiness, and because we've seen that we can do things to manipulate the world to get that happiness, we start acting in those ways and we want things. And then when we get them, we're happy. And I think I talked about this recently. When we get those things, we're happy not only because we have them, but also because of the dissatisfaction, the feeling of wanting, which is an inherently unpleasant feeling. That feeling goes away. So the happiness that results when we get something that we want has this double hit of getting the pleasant and letting go of something unpleasant, or having the unpleasant thing be momentarily satisfied. So this kind of happiness is the kind that we are all, I think, most familiar with, the happiness of having things that we like around us and the happiness of not having things that we don't like around us. So this kind of happiness is really the least kind of happiness that there is. That it is, there are many, many greater happinesses that are out there. And one, in terms of this Dhammapada quote that I talked about, a wise person will forego a lesser happiness for a greater happiness. You know, with this kind of happiness of sense pleasure, we've been trained through all of our lives to get happiness in this way. And we believe at some deep level that this is the only way to be happy. You know, that constructing our lives such that it meets our needs, our satisfactions, our desires, that is really the path to happiness. And I used to be a mathematician, so there's this analogy that I like from mathematics and from computer algorithms, where if you're looking on a graph, I wish I had a piece of paper and a pen, but I'll draw it with my hand and let you see if you can see it. I'll try it bigger on the back of this one. So if you have something like this, a graph that looks kind of like this with a small peak and a large peak. The small peak, if we're at the top of this small peak, we look around us and, you know, if it's foggy or something, we're not going to see the higher peak. And we look around us and we think we're at the top. We think we found the best there is if we're at the top of this small peak here. And anywhere we look, all there is just going down. So why go down? But then if the fog clears, we see perhaps that there's this other peak over here. And in the mathematical world, searching to find the highest part of a graph, you have to know that sometimes you have to go down to find a higher point. And that's kind of the way this kind of happiness functions in our minds, that we think it's the best there is because we don't actually know. There's a vast fog around us that prevents us from seeing these other kinds of happiness. And anywhere we look is less happiness. And as we engage in the practice, we start to understand that there are some other ways to meet happiness, to have happiness in our lives. Essentially, the happiness of letting go. And but in our practice, for a while in our practice, part of what we have to do in order to learn about that happiness is to meet the suffering. So in a sense, we have to let go of the happiness we're familiar with and move through something, a terrain that feels like suffering, in order for the mind to really learn how to let go of that suffering. So that's actually what I just did there, is kind of the whole arc of the different kinds of happinesses. So I'm not gonna go immediately to the happiness of letting go. That's actually the kind of deepest happiness. That's the happiness of the third noble truth, of letting go of all craving, all clinging. But the Buddha actually talks about a number of other kinds of happinesses that we can experience on the journey, on the way. If we turn our attention to opening to the happiness that comes from engaging in our lives in a new direction. So the first kind, the kind of most global kind, the happiness of the what is called in the suttas the householder life, or the life of daily practice, is the happiness of right livelihood. The happiness that we are engaging in a form of livelihood that brings us support so that we can support our family and our friends, and that we are not harming anyone while doing this. That happiness, I'll read this little section in here. It's called the happiness of possession. Do you imagine in the Buddhist teachings him talking about the happiness of possession? It's in here. What is the happiness of possession? Here, a family man or woman possesses wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his or her arms, earned by the sweat of the brow, righteous wealth righteously gained. When he or she thinks, "I possess wealth acquired by energetic striving, righteously gained," he or she experiences happiness and joy. This is called the happiness of possession. So this is a kind of happiness that partly in looking at the gradations of happiness is whether the happiness causes suffering. Is there harming happening in self or other as a result of this happiness? And at the grossest level, acquiring that wealth in a way that is non-harming, in the obvious ways of non-harming. You're not killing people. You're not enslaving people. You're not trying to sell them drugs or intoxicants. This ways in which you're engaging in your livelihood that are non-harming. This is a source of happiness to reflect on the fact that your livelihood is a non-harming livelihood. He also includes in this list the happiness of debtlessness, of not being in debt. That's a rare thing, actually, in our culture, because to purchase things like homes, we need to go in debt. So actually not that many of us are debtless to have that happiness. And then moving along in these kind of worldly happinesses, and these happinesses are happinesses that are on the direction of the path. I mean, the happiness of possessing wealth does have some of the craving and clinging, or may have some of the craving and clinging under it, but it's at least not harming, and it's helping us to move in the direction of cultivating the qualities of heart and mind that support opening to the deeper levels of letting go. As we engage in our practice, we have to work from the outside in. We have to let go of kind of the outer layers of holding and clinging first. The outer layers of things that cause damage and harm. Letting go of those things that are in the way of deeper kinds of happinesses. So another kind of happiness in this worldly realm is the happiness of generosity. That as we offer our time, our resources, our financial, our wealth to support aspects of the world that we feel are in line with our priorities. And this is a real exploration for us in terms of generosity. I like to think about generosity, the practice of generosity, as including a strong reflection on what are your priorities. If you think about what your resources are, your time, your finances, your material items, how do you want to use those resources? We can think of our resources as being a flow as opposed to static. And how do we want to channel our resources, the things that support other things to grow? How do we want to channel them? Channel them towards, hopefully, things that incline oneself and others towards non-harming. With generosity, there's this interesting experience, if you're tuned into it, that there can be. It's interesting to explore what happens for you around generosity. Sometimes if you're giving something away, you feel like you should give something away and you're not really wanting to give it away, there's some clinging onto it, there can be some tension there. There can be some tightness. So noticing that, noticing that tension and tightness, respecting it also. I mean, I know sometimes I get into certain states where I just feel like, wow, this stuff is so great. I want to just give all of my money to these teachers. And like, this is not so helpful. We need to be wise about how we offer our resources so that we are not harming self or others. And then there's the feeling of stinginess, which maybe is kind of along the lines of, well, yeah, I could offer it, and if that's not really, but I really want to hold on to that. So there's that feeling of stinginess that can go along with generosity as well, or can go along with the act of giving. The act of generosity is the open-hearted expression of giving. It doesn't have the clinging. So the practice of giving is the cultivation of this quality of generosity. And in the practice of giving, we may notice these feelings of stinginess or fear or worry about what we're giving away. As it moves towards generosity, we understand how to use our resources wisely in the world. And as it turns to generosity, the act of giving has this beautiful quality of producing happiness before you give, just in the act of thinking about giving something to someone. So it produces this happiness of, oh, I'm so happy to be able to give this thing to this person that they will be able to use, and I know they'll use it wisely. So there's the happiness that happens before we give. Then there's the happiness during the giving that happens while we're actually giving it. And then there's a happiness that happens after we have finished it. If we reflect back on the act, we can experience happiness again. When it is a truly generous act, when it really does not have that clinging to it, it can produce these three happinesses: the happiness before, during, and after giving. Another kind of happiness in this area of the worldly experience and our everyday, day-to-day life's experience is the happiness of ethical conduct. Again, this really points down to the happiness of non-harming, of knowing that you are not causing harm to others. The ethical conduct for us as lay practitioners is basically fivefold: that we refrain from harming living beings, we refrain from taking what's not given, we refrain from sexual misconduct, we refrain from false speech, and refraining from intoxicants. As we engage in ethical conduct, essentially with the underpinnings of that being non-harming, but if that's the way you engage in ethical conduct, is by just keeping the philosophy of non-harming and harmonizing. Really, ethical conduct is about creating harmony in the world. So it's again, it's about producing happiness, harmony being a form of happiness. So if you engage in ethical conduct in that way, you have the happiness of the harmony, and you also have the happiness of non-remorse. That I know everybody here has experienced a time when they've done something or said something, and there's been this kind of, ooh, I wish I hadn't done that. You know, I see how that hurts somebody. So without engaging in behaviors, using this kind of as a protection, this non-harming conduct as a protection, we experience the benefits, the happiness of non-remorse. We also, in this process, offer the beings who are in our presence the gift of feeling safe in our presence, which is a form of generosity, which just produces its own form of happiness. This happiness of ethical conduct is understood really to be the foundation for the whole of our practice. That with this foundation of non-harming and the kind of intention towards creating harmony in our world, the whole of our opening to all of the insights in this practice can arise. I'll read to you how this is understood. Here, Ananda is asking the Buddha some questions. So Ananda says, What is the benefit of virtuous ways of conduct? What is their reward? The Buddha replies, non-remorse, Ananda, is the benefit and reward of virtuous ways of conduct. And what is the benefit and reward of non-remorse? Gladness, Ananda. And what is the benefit and reward of gladness? Joy. And what is the benefit and reward of joy? Serenity. What is the benefit and reward of serenity? Happiness. And here, this is interesting. I looked up the Pali for these three kinds of happiness, gladness, joy, happiness. They're different terms. I look at gladness as being the kind of everyday kind of happiness. Joy, the term that it's translating, is mental pleasant feeling. And happiness is translating the term sukha, which is basically a sweet emotion, the kind of purest sweet emotion. And what is the benefit and reward of happiness? Concentration of the mind. And what is the benefit and reward of concentration? Knowledge and vision of things as they really are. And it goes on with some kind of confusing terms, so I'm going to stop there for the moment. So basically, through this process of connecting with this non-harming conduct, we set the stage for the cultivation of all of these other beautiful qualities, leading to being able to understand knowledge and vision of things as they are, which is where our insight practice can really begin, as we can meet our experience and truly understand things as they are. We start to see the impermanence, the dissatisfactoriness, the not-self nature of our experience. And again, I jump over to the deepest kind of happiness. There's yet another happiness in between, which referred to in this sutta. So, the happiness of virtue, of non-harming, sets the stage for us to experience a deeper kind of happiness of concentration. So the in that sutta, the arc of it was non-remorse leads to gladness, leads to joy, leads to tranquility, leads to happiness, leads to concentration. So here, I find it very interesting, actually. Happiness, this form of one, there's the kind of normal everyday happiness, the gladness, which sets the stage for us to settle down our minds. And our minds become tranquil and serene. When there's not the agitation of worrying about having harmed people, the mind settles down. It becomes more quiet. It is able to become concentrated. It's able to settle. It's able to begin to see things as they are. So this the settling of the mind, in this sutta it points to this happiness of sukha, the sweet quality of happiness, of just a purity of happiness, a happiness of purity of mind in a way, is the proximate cause for concentration. So this is very interesting. Most of us, at least in my early days of meditation, I didn't have any clue that happiness was a proximate cause for concentration. And I was just sitting there, okay, get concentrated, you know, force the mind to the breath. And this is actually running counter to the way that concentration naturally develops. So finding ways to open to happiness will support the development of concentration. So finding ways to be relaxed and joyful in the engagement of attending to our experience. So this is an exploration for each of us. And I think each person may have a different pathway along these areas, different ways that support this cultivation of a happiness that supports concentration. So this takes some inner exploration. For myself, it was really, I had to let go of the really pouncing on the concentration and move to a much more open style of practice. Being much more that kind of practice I did in the guided meditation. And with an ease, a fluidity in that place, happiness comes pretty easily. And from that place, I can then begin to guide the mind very gently towards concentration. Other people have a much more natural facility. They get really happy when they just settle down with the breath. And that supports them. There's a happiness just by, I can let go of everything else and just pay attention. What a relief. I can just pay attention to the breath. And there's a happiness that comes from that. So exploring for yourselves, everybody's minds are different. With this concentration comes an actually a deeper level of happiness than the happiness that precedes the concentration. When we turn our attention in a very deep way to our mind and our mind and our body really like this attention. And it's like the cells of our body just start sucking up the attention. It feels like you're just being nourished. Like it's just this incredible elixir of food feeding your whole system, this experience of concentration. It's a very deeply satisfying experience. Easy to get stuck in that satisfying experience. It feels so right. Why would I not want to hang out here? So that's yet another deeper kind of happiness that is so far superior to the happiness of sense pleasure. It is a form of pleasure in the body, but it's not coming through grabbing onto things. It's actually coming through letting go and allowing the mind to settle down. With this happiness of concentration, with the mind in the space of concentration, there's the possibility, as the sutta I read describes, of seeing things as they are. And this moves into the happiness of insight. The happiness of actually recognizing, of not resisting things as they are. This is really the deeper happiness of letting go. Of not needing to change or resist or fix anything, but just meeting, moment to moment, meeting experience. So this is the happiness that's referred to in the Third Noble Truth, the happiness of the release of the craving, the release of the clinging. And this is said to be the deepest, the highest happiness. And we can get flavors of this, that the highest happiness is when all craving is said to be when all craving is completely released from our system. There's no possibility. We so deeply understand the happiness of insight is really into the understanding, the insight into impermanence of every experience. The unsatisfactory nature of any experience with respect to being a place that can provide a lasting source of happiness. There's no experience out there that we can have that is going to do it for us forever. It's just not going to happen. So inherently, every experience that we have is unsatisfactory as a source of this ultimate kind of happiness. There's nothing that we can hold on to that will make us happy forever. And this third insight into the ephemerality, the not-self nature of experience, the recognition that there isn't anyone here, actually, to do anything, to control or fix or change. There's not an entity here. There is a process. There's a continuity of a process that's going on. It's not just, you know, random bits and pieces put together. There's a flow of cause and effect that is a continuity. And we misinterpret that flow of continuity as being a thing. It's being solid and stable and lasting. There's nothing solid and stable and lasting in our experience. And what we think of as self, what we think of as me, is an idea. It's a form of identification. It's a process that happens in our mind. And so insight into these three areas brings a very deep kind of happiness. It's the happiness that comes from realizing that there is nothing to hold on to, and there's no one here to defend or protect. I know that this topic of not self, that there is no one here, can be very threatening in a way. You know, it feels so foreign to what our experience is. I mean, how can it possibly be true? Here I am. I know that I'm here. And so it's kind of threatening to let that idea in. But all I can say is just keep exploring your experience. Keep noticing where it feels like, here I am. And notice how it changes, how it shifts, how it mutates. Just keep exploring it. In my own experience, the letting go, or the realization in a moment of not self. And you can have a realization in a moment and recognize clearly, wow, I'm not here. Or not, you don't realize that I'm not here. There's just, you know, coming back, you realize, wow, I wasn't there. I'm not here. You know, I don't really exist. There's kind of this mind-blowing kind of recognition. And it can go away. So you don't, having that recognition at one point doesn't mean that you're fully enlightened. It just means that you've touched into that understanding and have an experiential recognition of that truth. But then the habits of mind kick back in and pick up all of those patterns again. And it can be a little confusing. You know, it's like, wait a minute, I thought I understood this. You know, why is this happening again? You know, so these, we can experience brief moments where we actually recognize and see deeply these truths. And there's a happiness that happens in those experiences, in that recognition of just letting go. That on one retreat, it came to my mind that the way the insight expressed itself in my mind was, not only is suffering produced by craving and clinging, but the thing that is being craved and clung to is merely a construct in the mind. So these different kinds of happinesses, the happiness of sense pleasure, of right livelihood, the happiness of generosity, the happiness of virtue, the happiness of concentration, and the happiness of insight. So, what are your thoughts? Wasn't I here last week?
No, weren't you on retreat?
I was just on retreat for a weekend. Oh, well, thanks.
I didn't know if you were
going to
come.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, well, maybe it's too much trouble. I have trouble with concentration.
Did you use the microphone?
Yes. I have trouble with concentration. I
think it's on, yeah.
It's supposed to be green, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't understand that concentration is happiness. I can see insight. what was it, insight? What were the four things?
The happiness of sense pleasure, of generosity, of virtue, of concentration, and of insight.
Yeah, we have the virtue and all those things. But concentration seems to me as something on the way to something rather than a...
Well, it is. I mean, it is the state of concentration. When the mind is concentrated, it's happy. So it's a different thing. I mean, it's not that the concentration is the happiness, but they are intimately interconnected.
So it's being able to go to a deeper level of experience by concentrating. Well, here I am, I'm using concentration as a way to get there.
Well, the concentration, I mean, like I described, in the state of concentration, it's like, what it feels like to me is like all my cells are pointed in the same direction. It's like everything is aligned. Everything is moving in the same way. And the attention that is directed to the body in that state is like it's providing a nourishment for the body that it rarely gets.
Oh, okay.
And it feels really good. So if you have noticed in connecting with the experience of breathing, you know, that the mind settles down, that settling process is intimately connected with the concentration. And so even in the kind of early stages of practice, we begin to recognize, wow, if I just, you know, let things go and just keep coming back to what's here and now, the mind gets much calmer and it gets happier. So have you noticed that?
Yes.
Okay, so that's what you mean by it being on the way to something.
Yes.
So, you know, keep staying with that concentration, the happiness that comes along with the concentration deepens. It keeps getting deeper and deeper. As the concentration deepens, the happiness gets more and more refined, essentially. And even within concentration, there are, you know, four levels of happiness that are described. The happiness of... I don't know what the first one is called. I guess it's just the happiness of... it's kind of like the happiness of rapture with effort. Then there's the happiness of rapture without effort. I don't know what the name of that first one is. And then there's the happiness of the letting go of the excitement of the rapture, of just the happiness, the sweet pleasantness. And then there's the letting go of even the agitation that's around... that happiness, because that happiness is kind of a little flutter in the mind down to equanimity, which is an even subtler form of happiness.
Well, when I started meditating, I thought, well, I'll just wait till I really want to do it.
did that ever happen?
Real right time. Then I saw that I needed to do it. And then it's just beginning to really be pleasure.
Uh-huh, yeah. And so we can look at, I mean, if for you it's confusing to think about the concentration, I mean, like the happiness of virtue, it's not the virtue itself that's the happiness. The virtue is the way that the happiness results. So it's a similar kind of thing. You know, it's like they're completely intertwined. If you're behaving virtuously, as the Buddha says, non-remorse is the reward, you know, and that's a kind of happiness. If you are concentrating, the reward of the concentration is this nourishment of body and mind.
Nourishment's a nice word.
It feels like nourishment. It really does. Yeah.
I want to say I'm especially grateful for this place and to come here. And today I really appreciated the guided meditation. And the way I experienced today, it doesn't always happen this way, but it was really beautiful for me. I felt like I was in a cocoon and that I was healing all the cells of my body.
Mm. So you had that sense of that nourishment and that healing quality of the settling.
Yeah, I experienced it that way. At first I felt... It was very odd. I felt like I was in this huge raindrop that was connecting. And then all of a sudden I realized that I felt like I was in a cocoon, like a butterfly does. And that's the experience that I get here, and I don't get to come and experience it often, as, like you said, sometimes you would like to, but when I do, it's very beautiful and very healing for me, because I felt my body and soul healing when I come here many times, and today was very nourished by your guided meditation, which really helps me. And like you said, everybody experiences it so different, and just to know that is relaxing to me, to know that, and to hear you say that, because sometimes I think, you know, am I doing it right or whatever, but it's so different every time, and that's a beautiful thing.
So what you're describing, this cocoon-like experience, reminds me of a phrase that's often used around concentration, and it is the bliss of seclusion. And it's referring to, essentially, I forgot about this piece with concentration, as the mind settles down and gets concentrated, what is absent are the five hindrances. We are no longer being assailed by sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and doubt. And it feels good to have the absence of that agitation. So it kind of like the absence of remorse there, it's the absence of the hindrances that feels good as the mind settles. That's called the bliss of seclusion. And it can feel like that cocoon-like quality.
And it definitely refreshes me, because I do have, like everyone else, the world to deal with when I leave here. And so it's very refreshing to come here.
I'm glad.
And thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, pick up the mic.
So I had a question about right livelihood. And it seems like a fairly modest goal to not cause harm. But why isn't the goal to make the world a better place? Why is it to not cause harm?
Well, I think you'll find if you actively are not causing harm, you are making the world a better place.
But it seems, and I thought about that, but then it seems like it takes the next step to really sort of change the world in a better way. And it still seems very, I'm just thinking as I'm raising these two young boys in the world, and I always, you know, think that I want them to make, you know, I want them to have some vocation that makes the world a better place. But if my goal is that their vocation is to just not cause harm, then that seems very modest and easy.
It's not as easy as you might think.
I know. Under the circumstances of their life, it seems, well, yes, I know.
And so
you just look around and you
part,
think of all the
part of
too.
It is that, as I said, the ethical conduct is the foundation.
Yes.
It's where we move from. That's okay. The baseline.
Okay.
And that's just in order to make the world a better place, it really does have to come from a place of non-harming. At least that I really believe that. I mean,
so that's where it starts.
That's where it starts from.
And from there,
yeah.
It can go.
I mean, there are people who, you know, maybe have an agenda of making the world a better place, and yet the way they're going about it is causing harm.
Yes.
And so the I really actually really appreciate this about the Buddhist teaching, that it rests on ethical conduct. You're not going to be confused about am I enlightened or not if you're still running around causing harm.
Yes. Yes.
So yeah, I mean, and the Buddha recommended for his monks, I mean, actually, I don't remember if I read this part. The happiness, the second kind of happiness, maybe addresses this. The happiness of enjoyment for a householder. With the wealth acquired by energetic striving, etc., one enjoys one's wealth and does meritorious deeds. And so it's that moving out with wealth, not just holding it in, but the enjoyment of offering it to support others.
Yes. That makes sense.
Yeah. And I think you will find that if you find a non-harming occupation, you know, I think it does create a container just being a non-harming being has ripple effects that spread out and support others to have that same ripple effect.
Yes.
I mean, if we look at that first precept, refraining from not killing, if everyone on the planet followed that one precept, what a different world it would be.
Yes.
Any other comments or questions? Any thoughts? Yeah, thoughts, comments, everything about the guided meditation, the talk, anything. Hold it kind of like this.
Mine, and I'm not sure how it fits in what you're talking about, but I keep wondering about how my connection with other people goes into there, because some of it has to do with attachment. Some of it I really enjoy, say, sharing what I think are good values with somebody that I'm having a connection with, or giving something to somebody but without attachment, still enjoying that they appreciate it and benefit from it. But it tugs at me that I really want, let's say, I want to see that they are enjoying that. Sometimes I'm not permitted.
That's a great one to notice.
But I do want to feel my connection with good people who are also trying to do good in the world. And I feel a lot of happiness with that. And I see in your face that when somebody's learning something from you, you get happy. There's a lot of room for stickiness and clinging and stuff in that.
There is, yeah.
But I just had questions about that because I didn't hear, I don't feel like I'm alone in the world, although sometimes I do. Sometimes there's a happiness in being alone to nourish myself, but I'm just wondering about that.
So let me just restate your question to make sure I kind of understand it. That you're curious about the happiness of connection, and yet there being a kind of an agenda about that connection of wanting either something back or wanting to see that connection is returned somehow. Is that?
But just and the happiness and just experiencing it when it happens. When it I meet with somebody and I'm just very happy that we share an experience and share values.
Okay, so the meeting with somebody and being happy that you see that there's a shared community, a shared sense of values and
humanness.
Yes, the shared sense of humanness. So that experience of that shared connection, that seems to me to be also a kind of a pure, it can be pure kind of happiness of, the recognition in a way. I mean, it's kind of a give and take of beautiful qualities in ourselves, you know, that we are offering beautiful qualities. Almost this could be a scene under the realm of generosity in a way of offering the best of us to our friends and to our families. And that can be a very beautiful, wholesome kind of happiness. And as you said, as you pointed out, there is a lot of area for stickiness in there, of noticing the agenda, of noticing the desire for it to continue, or to, as I think in your first part of your question, you said when you give somebody something, sometimes you want to see them enjoy it, and you're not able to you're not permitted to do that.
Just the other part is often I do not give something because I'm afraid that they will not appreciate it. And I will not share a truth or something that feels like the truth or a question because I'm afraid it might be judged as wrong.
Uh-huh. Okay, so there's a fear of giving because of fear of being judged about the gift. That's a good one to just explore, you know, to just recognize it. I mean, all of these aspects of practice kind of come together in the pot, you know. We don't go from one happiness to the other kind of in sync. So in the area of having fear around offering a gift, that's a place for mindfulness. You know, that's a place for reflection, for understanding, for seeing if you can understand a little bit about what's happening with that that fear. And you may determine from that giving that thing right now is not the thing to do, or you may change your mind and say, well, I'll just go out on a limb. And, you know, it's just my fear of being judged that's here at stake. You know, it's like, if they don't happen to like it, that's not really any big deal. You know, it may just not be something that they would happen to have chosen for themselves or something. And the letting go of the feeling of judgment coming back, that's a great area of work in our exploration of not self. Because that's an area of selfing, essentially. It's noticing how we create self around how others see us. So exploring that, if you can start to let go of the fear of judging, of being judged, you'll start to see a happiness that results from that. And then let's see if there was anything else. Oh, the stickiness, the piece of the stickiness. Now, that's something, again, to explore with mindfulness. When you're engaging in interactions, notice where there's this desire for something in return. Noticing when it feels like it's not okay to offer this emotion if you're not getting something back. You know, to just begin to recognize the holding back, or the wanting to pull out of somebody, you know, a kind of an agenda or a contingency on the emotion. Well, I'll feel this way about you if you feel this way about me. Just again, bringing our mindfulness practice to all of that helps us to see where we are holding, where that self is being constructed. So did that address, is there, okay. Well, it's time to stop. So thank you all for your attention.